Good to see everybody. Good to be back. Forward to another study of 2 Peter. Thank Landon for reading and going back through the entire chapter. So this, as we just read, this chapter deals with primarily with false teachers. And then leading up to this, we're going to cover verses 12 through 17 this evening. But leading up to that, we had examples of how wickedness is punished in fallen angels in Sodom and Gomorrah. And then we had an example of deliverance for righteousness in Lot. And in the captions in my Bible, this section is called The Depravity of False Teachers. The first question covers verse 12, and I think Bart is up for this one. The first question is, what are the similarities between false teachers and brute beasts? Part B, what does it mean that they are made to be caught and killed? And what is the danger of speaking evil of things one doesn't understand? Let's just go back and read the verse real quick. But these, like natural brute beasts, made to be caught and destroyed, speak evil of things they do not understand, and will utterly perish in their own corruption. Bart, would you like to answer?
Well, what are the similarities between these teachers and brute beasts? I like the NLT's translation of this verse. It says, these false teachers are like unthinking animals, creatures of instinct, who are born to be caught and killed. They laugh at the terrifying powers they know so little about, and they will be destroyed. So, you know, it's casting a little shade on brute beasts, actually. I'm a little, you know, I feel bad for the brute beasts if they're getting, getting put in the same category as these individuals, because these individuals should know better. These are Christians who have fallen away from the truth. They have arisen, as we read just a moment ago, from within you. They have come out of the church, and yet they have left the truth, and they have become teachers of false doctrine. As Paul said to the Ephesians, to draw away disciples after them for greed and so on. And so they should know better than the animals. But the picture is of, a lion in Africa or wherever, the Serengeti, who is attacking villagers, and the villagers band together, and they have to destroy the lion, who's an unthinking beast. The lion doesn't know better than to attack villagers, and it ends up costing him his life. At least that's the way I see it. It's like a brute beast caught in a net. You might a jaguar in a net. It's trying to, and sometimes that happens, right? Even here in America, you have a possum or whatever critter is that causes trouble around the house, and you have to get rid of it. So that's the idea. Unfortunately, these they're irrational. I think that's the point, is that they're irrational and they're not thinking correctly. And part B kind of falls in the same idea. They're made to be caught and killed. That's not saying these individuals were made by God to be caught and killed. But it, what it's saying is that they're acting in ways that will end in the destruction. They have chosen a course that, like an animal, is going to end up in its destruction and its doom. And maybe part of this is because they once knew the truth. And so we're sort of talking about individuals whose hearts and consciences have been seared, right? These aren't people outside the church. These are people that know Christ, have been baptized, they've obeyed the gospel, and they've been baptized. They're members of the Church of Christ. And their hearts are seared, and so they're past the point, whatever that is, you know, we talk about what it means to be past that point of redemption, and they've reached the point where nothing's going to turn them back. And then the final part is, what's the danger? Well, the danger is, you know, speaking against God, blasphemy against God will be punished by God. The beast of Revelation 13 does this. God gave him a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, and he was given authority to continue 42 months. He opened his mouth in blasphemy against God, the blasphemy of his name, his tabernacle, and those who dwell in heaven. And then Paul said in Colossians 2:18, let no one cheat you of your you reward taking delight in false humility and worship of angels, intruding into those things which he has not seen, vainly puffed up in his fleshly mind, not holding fast to the head. So these people are treading, it's like a minefield, I suppose, although the minefield suggests a little erratic punishment, and the punishment for these people is not going to be erratic. Sooner or later, they're going to step on that mine, they're going to die, and then they'll face judgment. And none of us, obviously, should do that. There's plenty of people on YouTube now blaspheming God and taking his name in vain and saying he's the evil God and so on.
Thank you. Who else would like to address these questions? The similarity between false teachers and brute beasts, what it means to be caught or killed, and the danger of speaking evil.
Bart, what was the word that NLT used? Was it unthinking?
Yes, unthinking.
Unthinking. I like that word too. It's interesting in the Greek. It's the word aloga. So similar, meaning the opposite of or negation. And I would assume, I don't know the root word, whether it's logos or a form of logos, but same word where we get logic. And logos, of course, is translated the word, but it means something a little bit greater than that in kind of classical Greek literature, more the expression of the idea, something a little bit more grand. The NASB translates it unreasoning, that they don't think things through. So I just wanted to point that out there. They're the opposite of whatever Christ is, whatever God the Word is. It seems like it's the opposite word that's being used here to describe false teachers. I thought that was interesting.
Right. That is kind of neat. The ASV says it's creatures without reason. Who else would like to hear this? Bill?
I really enjoyed Bart's explanation. About the only thing I got to add here is that part B, what does it mean that they are made to be caught and killed? You know, wild beasts are often caught and killed for various reasons. You know, they say a fed bear is a dead bear. You know, that kind of thing. They learn bad habits. When you start doing, animals learn bad habits. And I think there's a comparison here with these false teachers. They've done something, they've learned a bad habit, and then they continue to expand upon that. And so I think the bad habit of the animal becomes its demise. The false teachers, they learn these same bad habits, and it catches up with them, either in this life or the life to come.
Okay. Dennis.
I agree with everything that's been said already. My definition goes along with what everyone else is, pretty much without reason, senseless, unthinking. I think part C goes with part A. They're not thinking, they're senseless, they're not using good judgment. Consequently, they speak what they shouldn't speak, and Matthew 12:37 tells us, you know, for by your words you will be justified, and by your words you will be condemned. So it's very important that you don't do that.
Right. Thank you. Anybody else? Well, the part B, what does it mean to be made to be caught and killed? So there's a fundamental difference between humans and animals. Genesis 1:25-26, and God made the beasts of the earth according to its kind, cattle according to its kind, and everything that creeps on the earth according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. And God said, let us make man in our image according to our likeness. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over cattle, over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him, male and female. So man made in the image of God. These people are giving that up to blaspheme God. You know, there's a similar thing we see in Genesis 8:2-6. I won't read that whole thing, but it's talking about, that's not right. 9:2-6. But it's talking about the animals. He gave Noah all the animals to eat. And then it ends that up, whoever sheds man's blood, for by man's blood shall be shed, for in the image of God he made man. So there's a difference there that they're giving up, really, their humanity in being brutish. Part C, I think we ought to at least look at the kind of parallel passage in Jude. Jude 10. But these speak evil of whatever they do not know, and whatever they know naturally, like brute beasts, in these things they corrupt themselves. So they're acting on their own natural instincts. Isaiah 55, 7 to 9, that's where God says, my ways are higher than your ways. They're not thinking of God's ways. And also, Psalm 5 and 6. O Lord, how great are your works. Your thoughts are very deep. A senseless man does not know, nor does a fool understand this. We are not thinking in the ways of God. Let's move on to question number 2. What are the wages of unrighteousness? What is the sin of carousing? What does it mean to be spots and blemishes? And this is verse 13, which reads, and will receive the wages of unrighteousness as those who count it a pleasure to carouse in the daytime. They are spots and blemishes, carousing in their own deceptions while they feast with you. Landon, would you like to answer this?
Sure. So, for the wages of unrighteousness, Paul talks about these in Romans. Romans 2:5, he speaks of the day of wrath, of when the righteous judgment of God will be visited upon those who have earned that destiny. In Romans 6, verse 23, is the verse that says the wages of sin are death. And then, if you look in verse 12, it says that those natural brute beasts, or those who are like the natural brute beasts, speak evil of the things they do not understand. And we know very well in Matthew 18, verse 6, Jesus says, but whoever causes one of these little ones who believe in me to sin, it would be better for him if a millstone were hung around his neck and he were drowned in the depth of the sea. So these are the wages that they are receiving are worse than a death of being dropped into the sea with a millstone hung around your neck. They're going to be receiving far worse punishment than we could ever imagine. Part B, this word, I think the definition is to drink with others in a noisy and lively manner. Carousing is to drink in a noisy and lively manner. And so these people are drinking, indulging themselves and their desires, and now they're even doing it in the daytime. Usually this is a night activity. You know, it's Friday night, let's go party, let's get drunk. These people are doing it day and night. In part C, what does it mean to be spots and blemishes? The word there for spot is spilos, or spilos, however you want to say it. And it constitutes an unwarranted, unsightly stain upon something. And it also describes the spots that disfigure. So Peter is picturing these men as foul spots. They are blemishes upon society. They are dirty spots. Ephesians 5:27, that he might present himself, the church, to himself in splendor, not having spot. Blemish is obviously a similar word.
Thank you. Very good. Anybody else? The wages of unrighteousness, the sin of carousing. What does it mean to be spots and blemishes? Bryce?
I just thought this verse over Philippians 3:19 shows their motive. Well, better it says, whose end is destruction, whose God is their belly, whose glory is in their shame, who set their mind on earthly things.
Thank you. Anybody else? Like Landon's definition there, I had revel or riot, party or debauchery, the Greek, sure, awesome, truffet. The is the Greek for that. And as Landon pointed out, 1 Thessalonians 5:7, this is normally practiced at night because people are, should be ashamed of it. But here these guys are. Anybody else for me? Question number 3. This is verse 14. Having eyes full of adultery that they cannot cease from sin, enticing unstable souls, they have a heart trained in covetous practices and are accursed children. The question is, what are eyes full of adultery? Why can't they cease from sin? How does one train their heart in covetous practices? And what does it mean to be accursed children?
Cole. So Jesus talked about a similar concept on the Sermon on the Mount. I'm going to quote two different sections. So Matthew 5, verses 27 through 28, read, "You have heard that it was said to those of old, 'You shall not commit adultery.' But I say to you that whoever looks at a woman to lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart." And if we flip over to chapter 6 and read verses 22 through 23, reads, The lamp of the body is the eye. If therefore your eye is good, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eye is bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. If therefore the light that is in you is darkness, how great is that darkness?" So that's what is being referenced here. There are people who are falling into that adultery of the heart whenever their eyes are met with an object of temptation. Instead of looking away, they actively entertain their eyes in their fantasies and violate other people with their eyes and minds, in a sense. So there's that. And then them not ceasing from sin is just hyperbole. It's like, oh man, they never stopped doing this. Terrible things. And how does one train their heart in covetous practices? Similar to how you train for anything, is through daily practice. It's through constant searing of the mind. And accursed children. So curse means under God's curse, which means bound for hell. But children is a reference to them being God's children. So they were God's children, but they're accursed children because they are bound for hell.
Very good. That last point. Who else would like to address it? Like the Cole's book of Matthew 28-29, you know, it'd be better to have one blind eye in heaven than two good ones in hell. Think about Job 31:1. "I have made a covenant with my eyes. Why then should I look upon a young woman?" So Job, a righteous man, he understood this. And he made a covenant with his eyes not to have his eyes full of adultery. Who else would like to address these questions? Eyes full of adultery. Can't cease from sin, training in covetous practices, or cursing children. Levi.
Certainly the primary application here is that of lust, because verse 18 talks about lewdness, but maybe another way we could commit adultery is, couldn't find the chapter, but I know Ezekiel goes into graphic detail about how the Israelites committed adultery in the sense that they went after other gods. And abandon God. So these false prophets here, in another way, are having eyes full, seeking to abandon God and serve other gods, gods of themselves or other people, at any point they can.
Very good point. A lot of the Old Testament prophets use adultery to liken to idolatry. Who else would like to address this question or question? So the skill in doing evil, if Ephesians 4:14, trickery and deceit is one of these skills. Ephesians 6:11, in the armor of God section, we have the wiles of the devil. You know, they're skilled in trickery. And then I didn't write down my notes for this one, 2 Corinthians 11:3. But I fear lest somehow as a serpent deceived Eve by his craftiness, so your minds may be corrupted from the simplicity that is in Christ. So false teachers like the devil use craftiness, trickery to mislead people. And then the last part, the curse of children, Matthew 25:41. Then he will say to those on the left hand, depart from me, you cursed, into the everlasting fire prepared for the devil and his angels. So hell was made for the devil. And we can kind of connect that verse back, or connect this verse in Matthew back to verse 4. For God did not spare the angels who sinned, but cast them down to hell and delivered them into the chains of darkness to be reserved for judgment. So these Christians, they chose this to be accursed and go to this place that was reserved for the devil and the fallen angels. Anybody else on this question before we move on? All right, the prophet for prophet. Question number 4, and this is verses 15 to 16. For they have forsaken the right way and gone astray, following the way of Balaam, the son of Beor, who loved the wages of unrighteousness. But he was rebuked for his iniquity, a dumb donkey speaking with a man's voice, restraining the madness of a prophet. Question number 4, discuss the account of Balaam. How did Balaam go from a faithful prophet of God to the example of what a false teacher looks like? Austin.
Well, everyone, I'm sure, is familiar with Jerry Dickinson's sermon on a prophet for a prophet. It's one of my favorite sermon titles, but that's exactly what Balaam is, and it really fits in very well talking about our conversation earlier with brute beasts, is the fact that these are learned behavior. They didn't start out that way. And I think that's interesting when you look at Balaam. He didn't start out as a prophet for prophet. What's even more interesting, in fact, Balaam is proof that there were prophets outside of Israel that were prophets of God, that were true and faithful prophets. So God is communicating to other nations in some form or fashion. I would wager that Balaam wasn't the only prophet out there in the world. He could have been, but he's actually a very interesting case that here we have initially a faithful prophet of God. And I thought about, I've got a list of sermon ideas. One of them is true sayings of false prophets. And I never really got off the ground very, very far, but Balaam says a lot of true things. In fact, it seems like he says all the right things initially. I'm not going to go beyond anything that what God tells me to do. I'm just going to follow whatever it is that he says, and you can either like it or don't like it. I don't care about any of your treasure. Now, of course he did, but initially, you can offer me all the money that you have, and that's not going to change things for me. And the problem was, he wasn't satisfied with that first answer that the Lord gave him. And he keeps asking, and he keeps asking. And eventually, of course, he goes with them. And he's still saying all the right things, but he's in the process testing God. Because he really does want all the riches that the king of Moab, Balak, has to offer. So as he's going there on the road. Of course, we're familiar with the story. He's on his donkey and just trotting along, I'm sure, pretty good. And the donkey sees the angel with the sword drawn, but of course Balaam doesn't. It's hidden from his eyes. So the donkey is just trying to get away and keeps running into stuff. And Balaam's, of course, not very happy about that. And the third time that this happens, the Lord opens the mouth of the donkey, and the donkey starts talking back to Balaam. And instead of responding, "Wow, I've got a talking donkey," he has a whole conversation with the donkey, trying to justify his reasons for beating the donkey and wanting. He said, "If I had a sword, I'd kill you myself." And then finally, the Lord opens his eyes. And it's interesting that this is, in Peter's epistle, it's this particular account that is mentioned as the rebuke, rather than him just being outright killed. And we know eventually that, of course, happens because the Lord tells him to go ahead and gives the same exact message. In fact, there's some very interesting passages that speak about maybe even some messianic type of inclinations in his prophecies. And then at the end of all that, I believe that's Numbers 24. No, it's 25. Soon as we get all this, then we find out that Balaam is actually the one that showed Moab how to get Israel to fall. And it's confirmed here that it was for the wages of unrighteousness. And it's almost kind of a double meaning word, because what Landon said earlier is exactly right. The wages of sin is death. But here, it's almost like the wages of unrighteousness are the physical money that he was offered. He loved that, and that's what the false teachers love as well. But ultimately, that is death. That love of that is ultimately going to be their demise. So it's kind of an interesting kind of double meaning word if you think about it from that. So I'll leave it at that, and then we can riff off of that base.
Yeah, the wages of sin in his case was death, because he was killed when Israel attacked Moab. Who else would like to talk about the prophet Balaam and his talking donkey? You know, if he was really interested in prophet, he could have taken that talking donkey around. Funny, good one. Who else would like to talk about Balaam? Well, for the B part, how did Balaam go from a faithful prophet of God to an example of what a false teacher looks like? The B part, what a false teacher looks like. 2 Peter 2:12, what we just read. "But those like natural brute beasts may be caught in the sword, speak evil of things they do not understand." It's kind of neat that Balaam speaking evil of this donkey because he didn't understand the angel of the Lord was standing there with a sword about to take off his head. And so this is a good example of that. Eyes full of adultery, verse 14. "Having eyes full of adultery that cannot cease from sin, enticing unstable souls." Back to Numbers. Numbers 31, I think it's verse 16. "Look, these women caused the children of Israel through the counsel of Balaam to trespass against the Lord in the incident of Peor, and there was a plague among the congregation of the Lord." So as Austin mentioned, it was Balaam's counsel that caused the children of Israel to sin. And verse 3, "exploit by covetousness." Verse 3 of this chapter. "By covetousness they will exploit you with deceptive words." And so Balaam was covetous. It's kind of interesting. I think it was Numbers 22. So in verse 20, God said to Balaam, if the men come to you and call you, rise and go with them, but only the word which I speak to you shall you do. In verse 22, God is angered at him because he arose and went. Didn't seem to make a lot of sense after God told him to do that, but if we look down further, verse 35 says, the angel of the Lord said to Balaam, go with the men, but only the word that I speak to you, that you shall speak. So Balaam went with the princes of Balaam. So the angel of the Lord perceived that Balaam had made the decision when he arose and went to not speak what God had told him. Who else would like to talk about Balaam? Mark?
Yeah, I agree with everything. I don't have much more on Balaam, but a parallel passage about men who behave themselves like Balaam, which too, Peter, of course, is talking about Christians who desert the truth, is 2 Timothy 3. 2 Timothy 3, Paul, probably Paul's last epistle, last words that he ever wrote. And he says, understand this, that in the last days, difficult times will come. This is the net Bible. People will be lovers of themselves, lovers of money, which is one of the main focuses tonight. And then he lists a bunch of other terrible sins. And then verse 5, they will maintain the outward appearance of religion, but will have repudiated its power. And, you know, that's just an interesting comparison between a form of godliness, the outward appearance of religion. So they're people that have, their consciences are seared, and they, because of greed, they have left the truth. And how much does your conscience have to be seared for a donkey to, you know, speak to you and for you not to fall down? You see an angel with a sword and then beg the Lord not to make you go, right? I think anybody whose conscience wasn't seared would fall down and say, don't make me go, I made a mistake. You know, have mercy on me. Or go back home.
Perfect. Anybody else on this question? Let's move on to the last question, which covers verse 17. These are wells without water, clouds carried by a tempest, for whom is reserved the blackness of darkness forever. The A part, how do these analogies describe the disappointing nature of false teachers? The B part, what does the phrase blackness of darkness tell us about the judgment of that bill?
Well, I was thinking about these empty wells. And if you thought back in that time, it was a big deal to know where the wells were. It was a big deal because most of the time we're on foot and we're probably walking miles at a time. So I want to know where the next well is. And so if you can imagine getting to that next well, and I'm looking forward to that cool drink of water, and the bucket hits the bottom and there's nothing there, that's discouraging. That's going to really take the wind out of your sails. And so that bucket clanking on the bottom, these false teachers were a disappointment. Nothing good coming from them. So that's kind of my comparison with the wells and the false teachers. I found the blackness of darkness kind of interesting, and there are a couple other passages that use similar words. You know, this is a darkness like we can't imagine, is my thought. And if you've ever been in those cave tours when they turn out all the lights, you know, you get a feel for total darkness. But I'm thinking this is darkness on dark. This is darkness times 100, you know, type of deal. This is magnified. It's outer dark. Outer darkness in Matthew chapter 8 and verse 12. And then Jude verse 13, it reads, raging waves of the sea, foaming, talking about false teachers. Raging waves of the sea, foaming up their own shame, wandering stars from whom is reserved the blackness of darkness forever. So that's going to be hell. Again, total darkness and the screaming and the gnashing of teeth. This is going to be scary.
That verse you just read, if you back up, it's the verse 12. It's got some similarity to this. These are spots in your love feast while they feast without fear, serving on themselves. They are clouds without water, carried about by the winds, laid out of trees without fruit, twice dead, pulled up by the roots. Who else would like to address analogies or the blackness of darkness?
Awesome. Just kind of looking forward to next week a little bit, because we're going to go through verses 18 through 22 and how this is setting that up is how disappointing the end of whatever the false teacher's promise truly is. It's showing the effect that they have on all of their followers, right? They talk big talk. They go in and they pollute everything that they're around. And I think the language that's used here talks about, you know, the verse there in Jude, how they pervert your, or their spots or blemishes on your love feast. Here in this verse, in verse 13, carousing in their own deception while they feast with you. So again, it seems to be people that once were Christians and then turn aside from that. And just the end of all of these things is a very dark, it's a twisted, it's a gross thing, and it's empty, it's disappointing. And that's what we need to think about when we think of false doctrine. Whenever we think about people who are going after these things, we need to have a sense of pity about that, about these people who are following after this, because their end is so disheartening, it's so unfortunate, that we need to try to help them in any way that we can to avoid that terrible fate, because it's like a well without water, just what Bill said. It's very disheartening, it's very disappointing. I was also thinking about when there was the fig tree that Jesus cursed. I forget where it's at, I forget exactly what Jesus said afterwards, but I think it's kind of following that same line of things. It was supposed to boast figs. It was in the right time for figs. It looked like it should have figs, and it didn't. And Jesus cursed it. And I don't think it was about the fact that Jesus really wanted a fig at that moment and couldn't get one. I think it was probably a bigger lesson in mind.
Yeah, very good. That is maybe your point. We're supposed to worship in spirit and truth, but you know, it's not sufficient to just go through the motions. We need to have the right mindset and the right heart. We've got to examine ourselves. Who else? The last part of this, I'm going to go through this right before we give the invitation. So, what does the phrase blackness and darkness mean? Genesis 1, 3 to 4. So the second thing created, at least what I'm counting, is light. Then God said, let there be light, and he saw, and there was light, and God saw the light, and it was good. And God divided the light from the darkness. John 1, 4. Talking about Jesus. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. Jesus is life. Revelation 22:5. There shall be no night there. They need no lamp, nor light of the sun, the Lord God gives them life, and they shall reign forever. God is the light of heaven. Darkness is the absence of God. This time we give the gospel invitation. If you are not a Christian, you won't be able to experience that eternal.